You are listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. My name is Rob Canton, and the ever persuasive John Scott persuaded me out of retirement to step out for a while, and the temptation was that I would have the honour of introducing Fergus McNeill, who's going to give this afternoon's presentation. Before I say anything about Fergus, I'd just like to say that I was looking through the list of people who are likely to be attending today and thinking what an extraordinarily fine lineup of scholarship it was, seeing the names also of a number of older friends and newer friends. So it's a shame that we aren't all able to get together and that I can't see you all in person, but it's delightful to make virtual contact with you anyway. So let me introduce Fergus, because I mustn't talk for too long. Fergus McNeill is Professor of Criminology and Social Work at the University of Glasgow. And before he became an academic in 1998, he worked for 10 years in residential drug rehabilitation and as a criminal justice social worker. His research projects and publications have focused mainly on institutions, cultures, and practices of punishment, rehabilitation, and reintegration. And as well as exploring how, increasingly, knowledge about desistance from crime might shape rehabilitation and reintegration within and beyond criminal justice, Fergus's work has increasingly used creative and ethnographic methods to better understand how criminal justice is experienced, both by those subject to it and by those whose job is to try to realize it in practice. And I particularly think in this connection of Fergus's talents in fostering the talents of other people in the creation of music, songwriting, singing. Fergus is now leading a major five-year research study, which began in January this year, funded by the European Research Council Advanced Grant Scheme on rehabilitation and reintegration in Europe, working with colleagues in Miranda Boone and Hilda Verminck at the University of Leiden and Thomas Ugelvik from Oslo. Fergus's book, Pervasive Punishment, Making Sense of Mass Supervision, was the winner of the European Society of Criminology's Book Prize in 2021. It is, incidentally, a wonderful book. And his latest book, which I confess I know rather less well, edited with Mary Corcoran and Beth Weaver, is on generative justice and was published at the beginning of this year. So that's what it says on the tin, but I'd like to add a few words of my own. I've known Fergus now for approaching 25 years. First of all, we met when he was an external examiner on the BA Diploma in Probation Studies at De Montfort University. And he managed the sometimes tricky combination of kindness, good judgment, while carefully defending the standards of a program that is, after all, designed to ensure that our graduates were people who could work effectively and justly with some of society's most vulnerable people, to support them in their change and to protect the public. But later I enjoyed a number of opportunities to meet and work with Fergus in all kinds of places. From memory, these include London, Freiburg, Brussels, Strasbourg, Dublin, Helsinki, and even somewhere as far away as Leicester. An excellent companion on all occasions, socially and professionally. We often exchanged ideas about our shared interests in probation, social work, and punishment. And Fergus has always been generous in attending to my own views and encouraging and courteous when he put me right. So while the formal script of introduction invites respect and admiration for his scholarship, it doesn't do justice enough to these wonderful personal qualities. And Fergus's scholarship is all about doing justice, and he inspires us to emulate that. Fergus, that's the introduction. May I hand you the virtual floor?
Thanks, Rob. That was a genuinely lovely introduction, much better than the usual biography written by the person who's about to speak. So thank you for being so thoughtful in that regard. I'm just going to share my slides to make sure I stay on track here. And yeah, okay. Somebody no doubt will shout in my ear if this isn't working. First of all, and most importantly, I want to thank John for the invitation to come and speak today and be part of a a dialogue, which I think we're going to do in two parts, with a second event on the 10th of June, where Miranda and Thomas and Hilda, who Rob mentioned, who are the co-applicants for the grant, which I'm talking about, the work I'm talking about today, they'll join us, hopefully, in a more of a round table discussion of what we're doing in the project, how we all came to it by our different routes and what we're all hoping to get out of it. But today I'm speaking from my own perspective about this new study, Rehabilitation and Reintegration in Europe. You are the first people beyond the project team ever to see our logo. It won't be the last time, I guarantee you. Over the next 5 years, we'll try and get it everywhere we can. And this is the official PowerPoint template, which no project is complete without. So nice to see it out there. It makes it feel as if the project is becoming real. So my topic is comparing rehabilitation, why, where, and how. And I'm going to try and answer those three questions roughly in that order. This is the plan. To begin with a brief, necessarily brief discussion of a very complicated ideal, or in fact, set of ideals, which are often contradictory or at least interwoven in ways which sometimes defy simplistic understandings and simplistic criticisms. So I'm going to say something about the rehabilitative ideal or ideals, and then something also about rehabilitative realities today. And through that initial introductory discussion, I think I'll begin to persuade you why rehabilitation still matters as an ideal and as a set of practices and as an objective inquiry, which is essentially what we're talking about today. Then I'll move on to the question of why comparative research on rehabilitation and reintegration is, we think, important. And why we've settled on the three sites that we've chosen for our comparison. And then in the end, the last part of the talk, I'll tell you how we intend to do it and try to explain our approach and the possibilities and affordances that we think it offers. And then I'll end with a promise and the prize that we're seeking, the goal that we have 5 years to accomplish. So, this dapper chap on the right-hand side of the slide is Francis Allen. And anybody who has studied rehabilitation seriously will be aware of his book published in 1981, The Decline of the Rehabilitative Ideal. That might seem like a strange place to begin a talk on the importance of rehabilitation and studying it, well, almost half a century later. But it's an important book. It was important at the time in summarizing a number of reasons why rehabilitation had begun to fall out of favor in the late 60s, 1970s. And Francis Allen was a legal scholar and one based in the United States. And his book is, I would say, an American book and also an Anglophone book. It's not that he was insensitive to or unaware of European scholarship. And it's not that he wasn't interested in making comparisons. There are some comparisons, interesting comparisons in his book between the USA and China, in fact, in terms of what rehabilitation might mean and what it might entail. But nonetheless, I think his idea of what rehabilitation is, of what the rehabilitative ideal is distinctively American, or at least Anglophone English speaking. So here's this quote: "When I speak of the ideal, I refer to the notion that sanctions of the criminal law should or must be employed to achieve fundamental changes in the characters, personalities, and attitudes of convicted offenders." So if we pause there for a moment, rehabilitation's target, its object, the thing which it's trying to address and change is the person who has committed the crimes. The reason for doing that, in the second half of the quote, is that it's not only in the interest of the social defence, which is actually a reference to European ideals, so the defence of society, the creation of safer societies, but also the interests and the well-being of the person who has offended him or herself. So that's how he defines the ideal the decline of which he is discussing. But if we kind of move right to the present day and across the Atlantic, a very interesting recent essay, a long essay on the historical origins and evolution of rehabilitative punishment has been published in the Crime and Justice, the annual publication of the University of Chicago, edited by Michael Tonry. And here, Michele Piffery is tracing the history of rehabilitation in Europe. If Michele's here, I apologize if I have just butchered the pronunciation of his name. I tried to look it up, actually, online, and I got all sorts of interesting versions of how that should be said, none of which seemed authoritative, so I just made something up. I've never met Michele, so I hope I'm not doing it too awfully. But this is a complicated and a story of a long history, a long and complex history. But the core point of it for our purposes is that at the same time that Alan is charting the decline of the rehabilitative ideal in America, Europe is not abandoning rehabilitation. Continental Europe in particular is not abandoning rehabilitation. In that continent, according to Piffery, there has been a long-standing argument or discourse or dialogue exploring the relationships between rehabilitative and incapacitative modes of punishment, both of which are, of course, forms of social defense, to go back to that idea. And a lot of that discourse is normative in nature. So it's less concerned with the science of criminology or with the efficacy of treatment or intervention, and more concerned with questions of legal principle. Of course, also in continental Europe, we have the influence on the rehabilitative ideal of authoritarianism and totalitarianism in the earlier part of the 20th century. And we have in the post-World War II reconstruction, rehabilitation being written into laws, national laws and international standards in ways which are undeniably influenced by that specific history, such that, Piffery argues, the contemporary European rehabilitative ideal centers on the recognition of social rehabilitation, itself a complicated concept which I won't discuss further here, but the recognition of social rehabilitation, which we might just take as shorthand as the rehabilitation of the person to society or in society, as a right of the person who has offended, and its conceptualization as the essence of punishment. I'll come back to that point in a moment, but just take away from this slide the notion that social rehabilitation, the restoration of a person within society, is the essence of punishment, according to this account. So you'll have spotted, if you've been paying attention so far, an obvious conflict, which I've summed up in the diagram on the right-hand side of this slide. A lot of the time when English-speaking scholars, policymakers, and practitioners are discussing rehabilitation, what they're talking about is correction or intervention or treatment to change what I've called the disposition of the person who has offended. So something is being done or is proposed, which aims to change their behavior, their attitudes, their beliefs, maybe even their identity or their personality, or their motivation, their capabilities, their capacities. So again, as with Alan's definition, the focus is very much here on change within the individual. By contrast, on the right-hand side of the diagram, we have ideas of rehabilitation which are more fundamentally concerned with the social and legal position of the individual who has offended and who has been punished. So here, positions implies attention to relationship contexts, to social networks, to social resources and social opportunities, to questions of citizenship, status and rights, and ultimately to belonging within a moral community and a polity, if you like. So, excuse me, I've just got a little bit of energy bar stuck in my throat, which requires a big sip of tea. So rehabilitation might or might not be about changing the dispositions of people who offend. It might or might not be about changing their social and legal position. It might be about how we should administer punishment, or it might be about what comes after punishment has been served. It may or may not be synonymous with correction, the language which is used so much in the Anglosphere, or about human and civil rights. And it may or may not be the core social function of punishment. That takes us back to the essence idea that Ifori mentions, but here I'm citing Ajit Dubois-Tadan, who makes this precise argument that the purpose or core function of punishment is to bring the person back, but in a position, into a position where they are fit and able to live well in the community. To try to parse that further and to think about the different dimensions that are in play when we begin to engage with rehabilitation from an evidence-based point of view, by which I mean not just drawing on evidence about which approaches are effective, has examined through evaluation studies or what works research, but also drawing on that much broader, and I would argue more fundamental body of evidence about desistance from crime, how and why people stop offending, and evidence about how people experience punishment and reintegration and reentry. So from all of that evidence, or at least from that strand of all of those forms of inquiry that I have engaged with, and worked alongside Alejandro Rubio Arnal, who's a Spanish scholar who did his PhD here at Glasgow, Alejandro sought to kind of draw that scholarship together into a model which improved and elaborated on an earlier idea of mine. So initially I had four forms of rehabilitation. I'll talk to those now and then I'll explain what Alejandro has added. So I argued as a long time ago, in fact, I see Shad's on the call today, and Shad and I originally came up with this together back in 2010, but never wrote that paper up. So I published something on this in 2012, arguing that personal rehabilitation refers to the development of the individual in some sense. And that doesn't just refer to offending behavior programs or interventions that target criminogenic needs. It's a much broader category that could include any form of personal development that is conducive to moving forward through desistance and towards reintegration. So education, vocational training, spiritual development, anything which is building the person's capacity is in the domain of personal rehabilitation. So in fact, the kind of correctional work that Alan is discussing in his version of the rehabilitative ideal is a subcategory of personal rehabilitation, which I would call correctional rehabilitation. So that's one. The second domain in my original formulation was judicial or legal rehabilitation, and that is about the restoration or requalification of the subject of punishment. So the return to a position where all of a person's civil liberties and civil rights are respected. They are fully restored in formal terms at the end of their punishment. Moral rehabilitation, I described initially as being concerned with reconciliation, sometimes associated with restorative or reparative practices. But I also wrote in initially some of the obligations that the state and the community might owe to the person who has offended if the state and the community have been complicit in any way in creating the social conditions that may have given rise to the offending. So there can be debts that flow in both directions, moral debts, I mean here. And then in the original formulation, the fourth and final element was social rehabilitation, which is kind of the informal social partner of judicial and legal requalification. So the fact that the court says, or the law says, or the state says, that I am restored as a citizen does not mean that my neighbour or my community or a potential employer accepts me as a restored neighbour and member of the community. So social rehabilitation speaks more directly to questions around destigmatization, social attitudes, social climate, and it is fundamental to acceptance and belonging, what we now sometimes refer to as tertiary or relational desistance, that part of the process or aspect of desistance where you've arrived into a place of acceptance and belonging. So those were the original four, to which Alejandro quite rightly added material rehabilitation firstly, making the obvious point that it's impossible to be integrated into a society if you lack the basic means of subsistence within that society. So a person released from prison with a tent and no income, for example, is not meaningfully rehabilitated and reintegrated. We need secure housing. We need a basic minimum income in order to integrate within and enjoy any meaningful social life. I mean by that not social life as in going out and having fun, but life within society. And then Alejandro also separated civic political rehabilitation from my original moral category to address re-qualification in a slightly different sense from the purely legal form. And here we're thinking about things like enfranchisement, so rights to participate in political processes, but also the opportunities to volunteer, to be active within a community. So it speaks to and is a kind of opposite of the disqualifications that often come with collateral consequences of criminal conviction. So civic political rehabilitation is about restoration in those senses. So those are the six forms that Alejandro and I have developed in order to try to articulate the complexity of rehabilitation. And often we use this model to draw attention to the blind spots in systems which are overly preoccupied with personal or correctional rehabilitation and fail to attend to other important aspects. So, we've established, hopefully, that rehabilitation is complicated and contested, and that the rehabilitative ideal comes in different forms and means different things to different people. Nonetheless, I think it's reasonable to say, even looking at international standards promulgated by the United Nations or the Council of Europe, for example, that we find lots of references to rehabilitation that span different systems, legal systems, countries, cultures, political configurations. And what's common, I think, in those kinds of documents is that they quite often place rehabilitation as a solution to the problem I'm trying to articulate in the cycle diagram on the left-hand side here. I'm not saying this is fully articulated in such documents. I'm saying it's maybe part of the logic that is somewhat accepted in the background behind these kinds of declarations. So the argument here, a criminological argument, if you like, is that inequality, objectively unjust social conditions of inequality, forms of structural violence, in other words, drive involvement in crime, and also, to be more accurate, criminologically speaking, drive uneven criminalization of involvement in crime. So certain populations on the receiving end or the hard end of social inequalities are more heavily criminalized, and then they find themselves punished. And punitive forms of punishment, particularly incarceration, exacerbate the inequalities that were implicated in the first place in crime and criminalization. So we get locked in a cycle of punitiveness, or what is sometimes called the trap of punitiveness. I should say this slide is drawn from the 5-minute pitch that went to the funder. And I certainly called it the punitive trap in that sense. So in order to break out of that cycle, rehabilitation is often proposed as the solution, right? That is the the spoke that we put in the wheel that breaks the cycle and that offers people an off-ramp or an exit from a relentless cycle of inequality generating criminalization, causing punishment, which exacerbates inequality. And so we have the problem of reoffending, as it's so often discussed in national and international criminal justice policy contexts. So the little green diagram is the escape route of rehabilitation, exiting from this disastrous trap. But you see also there's a stop sign here suggesting that in certain circumstances, it might be that we're misleading ourselves and that in fact rehabilitation turns out to be a dead end for many people. But why might I say that? Well, this is where we do the reality check. And here I'm starting not with scholarship, but rather with the report of the Justice Committee of the House of Commons in England and Wales. And this is their description of why, essentially, prisons are failing to end the cycle of reoffending in England and Wales at the moment. So you can see, without me reading out all the quotes I've selected from that report, overcrowding, arbitrary transfers, disrupted progression, reduced access to purposeful activity, education, family contact, buildings and infrastructure, unhealthy conditions, mental health problems, lack of education, and so on and so forth. So in the context of bloated prison systems that can't even provide decent conditions, which people might at least be better able to endure, well, that context, that situation makes a mockery of the notion that our system might be, or the system of England and Wales might be, meaningfully rehabilitative. And this isn't a problem which is specific to England and Wales, I would argue. Many systems, many penal systems are overcrowded. Many of them are struggling to cope with the consequences of populist penal policies producing expansion. I know that there are different stories in different countries and rises and falls at different times in different places. But even if we set aside the problem of overcrowding, like the management problem of prison populations, we've got bigger changes in the background that sociologists of punishment have charted over the last 50 years or so. And this story is familiar to anybody who studies this. So again, I'm going to be very superficial in my skating across the surface of it. But we have the decline of post-war penal welfareism, again, linked to the decline of the rehabilitative ideal. We have the recasting of rehabilitation, most elegantly articulated by Gwen Robinson in a still very important paper on late modern rehabilitation published 18 years ago, which charts how rehabilitation has to switch register and language and serve different purposes. So it's no longer about rescuing people trapped in that punitiveness. It's instead about cost effectiveness, or it's about managerial efficiency, or it's about holding people to account in a particular way, or it's about the reduction and management of risks that people pose. So in this model of rehabilitation, crucially, the person who has offended is no longer a subject to be engaged with in a process of change and support, but rather as the object of interventions imposed on that individual in the putative interests of others. So unlike in the first slide, where Alan puts the interests of the community and the interests of the individual alongside each other, stressing their consonance, here in late modern rehabilitation, the dissonance, the clash between the interests of the individual person who has offended and the interests of the community that must be protected from that risky person, that dissonance is becoming ever stronger, which paradoxically drives more punitiveness rather than more rehabilitation. However, it's not that simple a story, and these developments are perennially contested, as so beautifully articulated in this wonderful book, Breaking the Pendulum, which is largely about North American criminal justice policy and its evolution and development, but I think is incredibly useful for anybody studying the development of systems of punishment anywhere. So they nuance the picture by helping us understand why there's very rarely an actual pendulum swing that completely eliminates one ideal and replaces it with something radically different. So there's no pendulum swinging between punitiveness and welfareism, or between incapacitation and rehabilitation. Rather, there's an endless contestation, and at any point in time, in any given place, certain ideas are winning out for very particular reasons. So that work's important. But at the micro level, these are kind of macro and meso level accounts of penal change. At the micro level, ethnographers studying what's happening within these systems, when they touch upon rehabilitation and how that's being experienced by people subject to it, the story that they're telling is, by and large, pretty bleak story. And it's bleak actually both from the perspective of lived experience on the receiving end and practice experience under the pressure of these risk-based regimes. What we end up with, to use Ben Crew's language, is the exercise of soft power. So the brutalities of earlier eras of imprisonment have been displaced by a new kind of psychological soft power, where people's progression through systems and to release and reintegration is conditional upon the performance of a certain kind of transformation that's prescribed by the system. And that progression is policed by psychologists and probation officers within these systems, producing painful experiences of rehabilitation, painful violations of autonomy, and human dignity. It could certainly be argued from some of those studies. So the kind of tension between the escape route and the dead end, I think, gives us the argument why we should study rehabilitation now, why it's still important to study it, because it's not going away. But we don't really know in a systematic way what is and isn't being achieved in its name. So that encourages us to keep studying rehabilitation, but why comparatively? Well, here I'm going back to the words of Niels Christie, whose picture that is, and the simple reminder that penal systems carry deep meanings, and they tell us something fundamental about the nature of the states or societies that they represent. And I would argue that can be better understood when we examine these systems in comparative context. But what should we compare? Well, most comparative penology or comparative studies of criminal justice tend to focus, I think it's fair to say, on the more severe end of sanctioning systems. So we have quite a lot of good research comparing prison rates, comparing punitiveness, some work comparing prison conditions, and very recently, again in the work of Ben Crew and his colleagues in the CompPen project, we have richer comparative work looking at the texture of imprisonment, as he calls it. That is the more kind of fine-grained ways in which we understand how imprisonment is experienced in different systems. So we have that work looking at the hardest end of the system. We also have comparative work on life sentences. I saw that Dirk was in the call as well. His work with Catherine has been hugely important in that regard. And we've got comparative work on death penalty, abolition or not. But we don't have a huge amount of comparative work on what is often seen as the softer end of the sanctioning system. Now, I obviously want to problematize that characterization. That's why I've referenced my own book, Pervasive Punishment, here. And part of the argument of that book is that when we neglect sanctions that we assume to be relatively benign, we fail to see the amount of harm that might be being done unintentionally. And indeed, if we don't study those aspects of punishment critically, we risk net widening and expanding the reach of the penal system, not just the reach across people, but also the reach of the system into people's lives, hence the double meaning of the title, pervasive punishment. It's both about pervasiveness across society and pervasiveness within the lives of those affected by supervisory forms of sanction in that case. So that work, I hope, established the importance of studying not only the most severe end of penal systems, but to go back to Ferry, he says, we have to trace the history of the rehabilitative ideal, including its contradictions and its unfulfilled promises, to shed light on the ideas underpinning the power to punish. It's a litmus test of legitimacy and foundational values. So rather than picking cases then where the worst things are being done in the worst ways, in the worst systems, if you like, crudely speaking, our idea was to do the opposite, to look at what is generally regarded as the more benign aspects of penal systems and to look in the places where it's sometimes assumed that this is being done relatively well. Now, that's contested. And of course, in the application and in everything we will ever write about this, we will question and challenge the claim that these are straightforwardly progressive countries. I'll come back to Robbie Burns in a minute, but let me just explain the choice here. So we picked three countries for our comparison. We have Scotland, and the significance of this picture is that chap on the left is Douglas Ross, who at the time was the leader of the Scottish Conservative Party, so a right-wing party. And here, the story is about him advocating for a legal right to rehabilitation. Now, it's a slight stretch here, because what he's talking about is access to drug rehabilitation. But nonetheless, I think there's still something important in that picture, because it tells us that in this country, in my country, Scotland, a right-wing politician is still prepared to sign up to the idea that people struggling with drug-related problems, alcohol-related problems, and with associated problems with crime, homelessness, mental health, needs to have a right to access treatment and support. I'm pretty sure that Douglas Ross's ideal of rehabilitation is a correctional one, which places much of the responsibility on the individual. But let's set that aside for the moment. In Norway, that's a picture from one of their famous prisons. I've momentarily forgotten the name of it. And again, it's one of those prisons which visitors are always going to and being impressed by in terms of the quality of its rehabilitative regime. And the Dutch picture is actually a picture of an empty prison, referencing the sometimes success of the Netherlands in terms of decarceration and greater use of community sanctions. So just before I go on to the how we're going to do this, I wanted this little Scottish quote, indeed a Scots quote in the Scots language, which I will translate for you. That's Robbie Burns, and this comes from one of his poems. He's the greatest of all Scottish poets, some would say the greatest of all poets. And he has this answer to the question of why we might compare ourselves. So he says, "Oh," I'm translating now, "oh, would some power give us the gift of seeing ourselves the way that others see us." What a gift that would be, if we could see ourselves as others see us. It would from many a blunder free us and foolish notion. What airs or what pretense or pomposity in dress and gait, you know, the way that we carry ourselves, the pomposity with which we carry ourselves, the kind of undeservedly positive self-appraisal that we convey would depart instantly if only we could see ourselves the way that others see us. So I think what Burns is getting at here, humorously but also brilliantly, is the significance of trying to move your position, trying to question your position. So we can only study the cultures and systems that we are part of from inside those systems. But if, as has been my experience in previous comparative research, if we can work with others the project and process of explaining ourselves to others is enlightening, not just for the person receiving the information, but for the person conveying it. So some of my most illuminating conversations about Scottish criminal justice have arisen in contexts where I've been trying to explain why we do what we do to somebody from France or Norway or the Netherlands or any other country. So that we see back reflected in the eyes of the person that we're speaking to, something strange, some of the strangeness of our way of doing things. And then having noticed that reaction, we start to dig deeper into why what is familiar to us is strange to them and vice versa. And we learn a lot in that process. So that's the core argument, one of the core arguments for comparison. How will we do it? I'm conscious of time here, so don't worry, I'm nearly finished. How will we do it? So this is our concept model for the project. We've got the three countries as the vertical dimension here, and then we've got four work packages and six concepts of rehabilitation. So the six forms I've explained already, and they provide us with a kind of analytical framework that we apply to every work package and to the project as a whole. So the first work package, which I'll say a little bit more about in a moment just to finish, is about studying the rehabilitative ideal in each country and then comparing those ideals. The second is about the scale and shape of rehabilitation. So this is about the quantitative measurement of who and what is wrapped up in systems of rehabilitation, how much is being done, at what cost, in what way, with which populations in each country. So a part of that, I hope, will be about following the money to see what it is that we're investing in when we talk about rehabilitation in policy terms. But it's also profiling the populations that are being rehabilitated and so forth. The third work package is about the technologies. And by that, I don't mean only new technologies or digital technologies. I mean any kind of tool or technique. So casework. Old-fashioned casework is a technology here, just as much as an electronic tag or a virtual reality therapy group or a smartphone app which gives you regular encouragement to check in or whatever. So we look at the technologies in work package three, and then in work package four, which is more ethnographic, we zone in on the practice and experience of rehabilitation. Largely using interviews and some observations, but also using creative workshops to allow people opportunities to explore and represent their experiences. One of the nice benefits of using creative methods here is that we will produce artifacts that will travel across the countries and be discussed by participants in different places and interpreted by participants in different places, and will also be part of public exhibitions in each country towards the end of the project. So that's broadly the shape of the project, just to explain very briefly who's doing what. So we've got Miranda and Hilda and Ulla, who I think is on the call, Ulla Kumans, who's the PhD researcher in the Netherlands. In Norway, we have Thomas, and a PhD researcher yet to be appointed. In Scotland, we have me working with Fern Gillen, Amy Cullen as our postdoc researchers, and also with Dina Koliaku-Ginsburg, who I think is also with us today, as our PhD researcher. The PhDs are mainly focused in work package four. Myself, Miranda, and Thomas are responsible for work package one. Hilda and I are in work package two, and work package three is kind of split between different people, different ways in different places. So that's the shape of the project and the team. In terms of our kind of methodological innovation, we are assessing vertical consistency and coherence within the country. So we're looking at the six forms and seeing how the ideal tracks with the investments, with the technologies, with the practices and the experiences within country. And then obviously we're looking for similarities and differences across the countries. That's not particularly innovative. But the addition of creative methods, I think, does innovate and help us find other means and modalities of representation. And it's not just lived experience that we'll be engaged with creatively. We will also have senior justice leaders in the creative workshops and frontline practitioners. So those creative works, along with the more conventional findings, will inform dialogue and dissemination events. And the crucial move is that we have a subset of the participants. So a subset of those lived experience experts, practitioner experts, and leaders, a subset get together across the three countries and work with us to make the comparisons. So we have participants in the comparison, not the comparison being only the function of the researchers who've run away with the data to do that themselves. So that's the aspiration. A very quick illustration of our workings, just to give you a little insight into the complexity of this once you start trying to do it. So work package one has this core question: has the ideal been understood, constructed, contested, and represented in each country? And when we met in Leiden a few weeks ago to talk about how we would answer that question, we ended up with this list of sub-questions just to illustrate the complexity. I won't dwell on any of this. So we want to kind of, we're now all working on answering 8 or 10, 9 questions and then drawing some conclusions in each country, looking at the historical and cultural factors that influence the ideal, looking at the key legal and philosophical scholars, looking at the policy and documents that reflect or represent the ideal's evolution, looking at the institutional, organizational, and professional structures and relationships, looking at the prevailing practice models, looking at empirical evaluations of effectiveness, looking at critical empirical work on the experience, looking at comparative penological work where it exists, but also looking at cultural representations of punishment and rehabilitation, and at national attitudes and dispositions towards it. And incidentally, if anyone's going to be in Warsaw for the European Criminology Conference, we're going to do a panel on representations, which covers everything from Scottish folk tales to Norwegian novels via continental medieval morality plays and Stoic philosophy. So that should be a fun one. And then we conclude by mapping all of the above in relation to the 6 forms. So which of the forms are we seeing emerging in each of these areas, and which ones are marginalized or completely absent? So to finish, the prize of that we're seeking, the goal of doing all of this, is to better understand whether and where, if anywhere, rehabilitation lives up to its ideals, and to creatively, critically, and comparatively interrogate its development, its prospects, coherences, contradictions, rhetoric, realities, possibilities, and pitfalls. You can see that one come straight out of the application, and it probably took me a week to put all those alliterations together. The ambition, the step change, which is what you're always asked for in these proposals, is both about a new approach to comparative penology, the biological approach, and more substantively, a new understanding of rehabilitation and how it might be developed further in Europe, particularly, but also further afield. I should say also, the aim here is to open source the methodology and the conceptual framing so that if any scholars want to pick up and run with this in other countries to add sites of comparison, we're very open to that possibility. And the website will be at that address when we get it live in the next month or so. So that's just a little preview of our website. But thank you very much for listening. I'm sorry I've gone on a little bit longer than I intended, but I shall stop there.
Angus, thank you so much. As ever, a really instructive and inspiring presentation. You've broadened and deepened our understanding of what rehabilitation might be. You've given us an indication of the value of comparative study. And I hope you'll forgive me if I counterpose your Rabbi Burns with something that Rudyard Kipling famously said: what do they know of England who only England know? Comparative study not only teaches you about other jurisdictions, but gives you an altogether deeper understanding of your own country. And then you concluded your presentation by telling us about the extraordinarily creative, co-productive research methods that you'll be adopting to try and find these things out. So thank you very much. And now I'd like to invite people to put some questions to Fergus. This could be difficult to manage, so I hope you'll all be kind to Fergus and to me. If people could put up their electronic hands, that would be warmly appreciated. So please go for it.
Just having a quick look at the chat, but I don't see any questions here. That's another alternative.
I do. Well, Marianne McFarlane has raised her hand. Marianne, can I ask you please to put your question to Fergus?
Sure. Actually, it was just a quick comment, Fergus, because you reminded me when I was doing my MPhil in Parkhurst, we were introducing shared working between prison officers and probation officers. And there I was thinking it was a benign and, you know, a helpful thing. And I did a very much a stakeholder survey, and the prisoners just described how much it didn't work. And it was just such a valuable lesson many years ago, but it stayed with me, and you just triggered that thought in my mind. So thank you.
Thank you. Nice to see you as well. It's been a while.
Yeah.
Thanks, Marianne. Other questions, please? Nina.
Unmute myself. Hi, Fergus. Lovely to see you. I've heard part of this presentation before at the penal reform event, so it was great to hear it in more detail. I just had a question about kind of transferability of different policies between those different regions. I'm thinking one example in the Netherlands. When I was in the Netherlands as part of an Erasmus program a few years ago, they had some incredible family support and rehabilitation, you know, support around family ties, both in prison and afterwards. And I asked them where they got, you know, where it came from, where this idea came from of developing this work. And they said, well, actually, it came from Park Prison, which was in Wales, and, you know, hasn't really kind of, you know, scaled up within, you know, across the UK, but was taken and then flourished within the Netherlands. So I'm just interested in, when you look and you're doing this sort of comparative study, how much you'll be looking at kind of how they've influenced each other and what's caused them then to be influenced by each other as well.
Yeah, I mean, and of course that also goes back centuries. Like because I'm intellectually locked in Work Package 1 at the moment, thinking about some of the bigger historical and cultural influences on the development of the ideal in each country. If you go back to the history of the Reformation, the links between Scotland and the Netherlands, and also the Enlightenment, you know, the flow of ideas has been happening for a long time between these countries in interesting ways. Even further back, one of my substrands at the moment is speaking to people in Celtic and Gaelic studies at Glasgow University about folk tales, and I have a very serious reason for doing that, as well as a kind of personal interest and curiosity about it. But once you start talking about punishment and rehabilitation as it features in those kind of more ancient traditions, or certainly early, I can't even think of the best way to describe the period of time, pre-medieval, let's just say, articulations of what punishment and rehabilitation mean. There are connections, obviously, Viking connections between Scotland and Norway, and what happens in the sagas and what happens in the Scottish folktales and so on. So I think those things are, the travel of ideas, therefore, is millennia old. I mean, the travel of ideas is as ancient as the travel of people. So that's not a surprise. But parsing that out identifying the flows, the specific flows related to rehabilitation, when we get to the empirical focus of this project, which I should say is on the 21st century. So while these things are interesting backgrounds, our substantive work is looking at development since the turn of this century. So yeah, I think we've got a lot of work to do there, for sure. something else that just popped into my head and has gone straight out the other side.
Can we perhaps move on, Fergus, if that's all right? Thank you so much for stimulating that particular line of discussion, Nina. Hadassah Noorda, please put your question.
Thank you so much. So I thought this was really interesting. And I'm a philosopher of law, philosophy of criminal law. I was wondering to what extent does the project move beyond comparing models of rehabilitation to addressing the normative question of what rehabilitation ought to be and what form it should take. Maybe more about it.
Again, I'll try to be super brief because I see a few hands up. So I think it absolutely must do that in two ways. One is in work package one, which is looking at the different normative traditions and philosophical articulations of the ideal in each of these three countries and doing some comparative work on that specifically. But then actually towards the end of the project, once we have gathered all these insights about rehabilitation from all these different forms of expertise and different positions, I hope that we'll be able to return to normative questions, but with evidence from our inquiry to inform the refinement of what the rehabilitative ideal could mean or should mean in particular conditions and circumstances. So I think the normative aspects are particularly important at the beginning and the end of the project, although I know from previous experience of studying rehabilitation, you're never more than as soon as you scratch the surface of the empirical reality of rehabilitation, you hit the normative foundations immediately. So I expect them to be ever present. But in terms of the focus of our work at the beginning and the end, they'll definitely be high on the agenda.
Thank you.
Excellent. It's the usual thing. You ask for hands and there aren't any, and then all of a sudden there are lots of them. So I think next in line is Eitor Martinez.
Hi, thank you very much. Thank you very much for this talk. My question is, my name is Aitor. I am a criminologist in the Basque Institute of Criminology. I've been a social worker, frontline social worker for 10 years in the UK. I'm in Spain now, but I was working in London. And I guess my question is around the notion of rehabilitation. I am researching now the systems. And for me, rehabilitation sounds pretty clinical. Also, I've worked in the NHS, so that is a very, like, clinically charged concept. So my question is, what's the measure of success? You discussed the domains of rehabilitation, but what's the measure of success when we're talking about rehabilitation? Is it assistance? Is it a good quality of life? What are we meaning when we talk about rehabilitation in this sense?
That is a great question. I could answer it now from the perspective of my own philosophical position, but I suspect the more interesting answer will be emergent from the research. Like it will be through, and in fact it links to the previous question, the dialogue between the different forms of expertise and across the countries, if it works, ought to generate a refinement of our understanding of what the ideal is, and only then can we ask questions about metrics or measurements that might best capture it. If you look at the six forms model as it currently stands, and of course, I should have said when discussing it, we're not assuming that that model is perfect or that it will cover everything. We fully expect to discover that it has inadequacies or that it's missing something important or that it's misdescribing something important. So we're open to that. But even if we took that model for the moment, if you think about those six areas, you can articulate metrics that might apply in each of the six areas. And indeed, that's part of the way that I've used it with policymakers and justice leaders to say, okay, you're measuring reconviction rates, but what do you know about educational outcomes or housing outcomes or the financial positions of people that you claim to have reintegrated? And that's what the model's intended to do. It's intended to challenge overly simplistic understandings of what rehabilitation is and of how it should be measured, partly actually to escape from that kind of clinical treatment logic that is, I agree,
sometimes too closely associated with the word, specifically in the Anglosphere, I would argue. But the word's a problematic word everywhere. So, yeah, we have to use it with a degree of caution.
Thank you.
It's not an abuse of the chair role to say that I think that was a great question and a great answer, because it has been entirely understood in terms of reconviction, and Fergus's broader conception of rehabilitation rocks that boat as it should. Vijay.
Thank you, Fergus. When I first saw the post on LinkedIn about the study that you were embarking, I was really excited. I teach at the Center for Criminology and Justice at Tata Institute of Social Sciences in Mumbai. I'm a professor there. And I have been working, on the issue of rehabilitation of, ex-offenders and prisoners through a project of ours, which we've been working for more than three decades. And I'd like to put a Global South perspective here, which is when we look at the issue of rehabilitation, especially in the Indian context of when we are looking at prison populations, there's a tremendous dumbing down of the term rehabilitation when it is equated with vocational training and a bit of lay counseling. Everything else gets passed on in terms of this is what rehabilitation is all about. In that context, the work that we've been doing over the years has shown us that there are, four indicators of rehabilitation. One is the issue of stable shelter. The other is of stable relationships. The third is of safe, stable legal income. And the fourth is the ability to control addictions. And overall, we've found that the framework has to be from client to citizen. And in that context, the need for having documents which proves that, you have a claim over citizenship and also access to government schemes and welfare programs. Now, in this context, I would be really excited if, in future, a study like this could be done across different cultural contexts, because the study that you're doing is located in Europe, where, there is a particular, similarity of cultural context. Though I'm not trying to homogenize it, but at the same time, if one looks at what does rehabilitation look like across different continents, I think that would be, a real important contribution, and there will be a lot of scope for cross-learning. Thank you.
I wholeheartedly agree, and thank you so much for that intervention. I think it's an important corrective, no pun intended, for a couple of reasons. One is that the Global North in this field has a dreadful track record of exporting bad ideas. And I was worried, actually, when you started speaking, that you were going to tell us another of the cautionary tales, which I hear from the Global South regularly about corporations selling correctional technologies to the Global South, claiming to be rehabilitative or diversionary or whatever. So I'm certainly alert to that danger and intensely concerned about it in the kind of globalized world that we live in, and given the power of commercial interests and the way that they play out in our context. So it was actually really heartening to hear what you then went on to articulate in terms of the model that has developed where you are. I think as well, I'm learning a lot at the moment about what might more broadly be called community justice in Global South contexts and from beyond the North and the West, actually, not just Global South, but Global East, if you like, contexts. And I'm entirely convinced that there's a huge amount to be learned in the Global North from places, particularly where the resources of the state are limited, and therefore communities are responding to problems of justice and problems of security in different ways. It strikes me that abolitionists in the North are arguing that we need less state. And if we were paying closer attention to what's happening where the state isn't so active, then we might have more concrete strategies for imagining alternatives to the things that we're getting wrong in the North. So I think there's a huge amount to be learned from dialogue that spans those bigger world regions. And there is some interest in some dialogue already using some of these models and frameworks with places beyond Europe. But off the top of my head, I can't actually think of any concrete leads yet in Global South context. So if there's interest in using aspects of the methodology or being part of the dialogue, I'd be very keen to do that.
Thank you for your question, Vijay. I don't know if you've been looking in the chat, but you'll see there are a great deal of support for your suggestions and a considerable amount of interest in this. And indeed, John has suggested just now in the chat that we have a round table coming up, and we may want to take that a little bit further on that occasion. Meanwhile, Dirk, can I invite you, please, to put your question or make your point?
Dirk, I think you switched the camera off instead of switching the microphone on.
Yes. Dirk, can you hear us? I think we can't see you now and your microphone still appears to be off.
Oh. Getting there.
Yeah, got you now.
Okay, so still not. Sorry.
We can hear you now, so.
Yes, there we are. Sorry about that. The point I wanted to make, I think, fits quite nicely with this. It's interesting if one looks at the concept of social rehabilitation. It's not used, to my knowledge, in any major European legal instrument, but it's very prominent in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which specifically lays down at international law, to which, of course, all European countries have signed up, a duty to provide for social rehabilitation. And use specifically the word social rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. So my question really is whether you think this is a line worth pursuing. And I suspect I have a specific question for you, Fergus. I noticed that when they were working on the Kyoto model strategies, there's a lot of talk about rehabilitation, and you were one of the people who was advising them. The Kyoto model strategies, I think, are not well known, perhaps not even to this audience, but they are the latest UN iteration of how, broadly speaking, rehabilitation should be approached by criminal justice systems nationally. So do you think there's anything worth pursuing there?
Yeah, I definitely do. So maybe for those who are not kind of au fait with the Kyoto developments, I was lucky enough to be asked to be a speaker at the UN Congress on Crime Prevention and Criminal Justice, which was supposed to happen in Kyoto in April 2020, ended up happening a year later. And sadly, my contribution was from my upper room for pandemic-related reasons, I should explain, not from the beautiful blossoms of April in Kyoto. The Kyoto Congress led to a declaration, which was initially in the preparatory meetings, the focus was entirely on reducing reoffending. It's actually why I kind of first generated that diagram about the trap of punitiveness. It was trying to kind of articulate a logic there. But what I did in the context of my involvement in the preparation for the Congress was really try to push towards enabling reintegration as the focus, rather than only focusing on reducing reoffending, because I think that the language of reducing reoffending tends to direct us to or sit alongside the correctional rehabilitation model. Whereas if you can switch the language towards enabling reintegration and then think about the complexity of forms, the six forms or the four forms as it was in Kyoto, then you can push for a more balanced policy agenda. And the reason I like the idea of social rehabilitation, at least as I imagine it, and Dirk, you will know much, much more about how this is described in declarations and statements of the sort that you mentioned. But to me, it isn't about individual correction. The social is doing a lot of work in helping us understand that punishment itself is creating a relational problem or exacerbating a relational problem between the individual and the society to which they belong, and that rehabilitation must find a relational solution.
And that the six forms model to me is also a relational model because it insists on the relations between the six domains. And I think that there is mileage in really trying to drive that home in every possible forum, and to kind of encourage the presence of that sort of logic in these kinds of statements, even if they're not usually very well known in the UK. These statements still shape thinking and can have influence over the course of years and perhaps decades. So yeah, I'm definitely keen to keep on pressing the social in the conversation about rehabilitation as much as possible.
The cartoonist Mel Kalman once drew a cartoon of a couple having a row, and one is saying to the other, "It's only you that's incompatible." And it seems to me that rehabilitation is often understood in that way. You know, here's a difficulty, but it's only one person who's to do with that, and only one person who needs to make any kind of change. So to restore the relational, I think, is crucial here. We still have a few more minutes, an opportunity for a couple more questions. The hands have died down, but please, if you have anything that you want to say, when we've exhausted the questions, which we never will because these questions will go on forever, I'm going to ask you, Fergus, if you would please, to just make a couple of remarks to close off the presentation. But for now, any more questions? I don't see any raised hands, so maybe now is a good time to ask you, Fergus, if you would like just to draw a couple of threads together, and then we can also, we mustn't forget to remind people of the round table that's taking place on the 10th of June. So over to you, Fergus.
Okay. Well, I'll be very brief and just say in the conversation already, and in sort of preparing for this and thinking about rehabilitation at the beginning of the project, I reminded that when I have written about or thought about the normative dimensions of rehabilitation, the more that I've examined that, actually also in the light of lived experience accounts of rehabilitation and evidence from disaster studies, it has seemed to be clearer and clearer to me that if rehabilitation is to have any effectiveness and any legitimacy, then it must begin with moral recognition. So the first nothing is possible unless the person that we are trying to reintegrate is recognized as a person of dignity and worth and potential. And of course, that's the language of human rights. That's the language behind human rights discourses. So that we start with moral recognition, but then the second stage, which actually has been made clear to me more from empirical criminological research, is that from recognition we have to proceed into dialogue. Rehabilitation, if it is to have any worth or value or effect, has to be a dialogical process. And there are quite a few different interlocutors in that dialogue, not just the person providing some intervention or support, but I mean also a dialogue between the state, the citizen, and the community of sorts. So one of the things that gives me hope about this project is that our methodology is dialogical. So we're kind of modeling something that we see, or I see, as also being intrinsic to the object of our study, if it is to be developed in an ethical and effective way. So yeah, I guess I can just leave us with the concepts of recognition and dialogue as the kind of precursors to anything else. A lot of the time, you know, when I was a practitioner many years ago, there was so much focus on the kind of the what works literature and the modalities of very specific interventions to address very specific problems, but there wasn't sufficient discussion of those core conditions to me of recognition and that core methodology of dialogue. And I think when we lapse into monological modes of rehabilitation, we're also lapsing into authoritarianism of a sort. And given the world in which we live today and the threats to democracy and the rule of law that are everywhere, we have to hold fast to principles of recognition and dialogue in the way that we conduct our research and in the practices that we're trying to encourage within and beyond criminal justice systems. So I'll end with that.
Thank you, Fergus. I love the way in which you've explained how your research approach chimes with precisely that concept of dialogue, mutuality, co-production, and so on. Can I just remind people that these discussions will continue when we have a panel meeting, when Fergus will be joined by other leaders in that project. And this takes place on Wednesday, the 10th of June. So please sign up for that. It's at 4 o'clock again, UK time, 1700 Central European time. And I think it only remains to thank everyone who attended, especially those of you who put questions, because I think those questions were particularly well judged and generated some absolutely fascinating debates. But thanks above all to you, Fergus, for giving us so much to think about. And I see that one or two people already began to raise virtual thumbs and virtual applauses and all the rest of it. So Fergus, consider yourself virtually and actually thanked warmly for everything that you've done. And I think this concludes our session. So thank you again, everyone. Thanks to you, Fergus, and goodbye.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.